Oh, you don't want it in your personal? Okay. Hello and welcome to WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Marcus Packer is helping to make New Haven tick. He's running for mayor and he's running hard, folks, including a stop here in the WNHH studio to update us on his quest. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Thanks for popping by the Independent. I'm going to ask you, Marcus, to get real close to that mic. Not quite touching it, but close enough. I want to hear you well.
Okay.
Thank you for making time to come by the studio.
Thank you for having me.
You've been doing a lot of stuff, man. We're trying to keep up with you. And if you want to call in with a question, you can just watch. But if you're on Facebook Live, you can post a question, and Harry Joyce, our station manager, will keep an eye out. We can ask Marcus, or you can call 203-872-7ELM, 203-872-7356. But just sit back and enjoy the show. Marcus Packer, thanks for coming in. So how's it going, man? How's the campaign?
Well, the campaign is going great, Paul. I'm very excited about the possibilities and potential for new leadership in New Haven. As I go out there and I talk to our residents and I talk to our seniors and I talk to our young people and taxpayers, everyone feels that they're ready, that they're ready to see some new ideas to be implemented into our city. They're looking for new leadership. They're looking for a fresh new way to do business and politics in New Haven, and I'm very, very excited about that.
So you are going to be on the ballot twice. Absolutely. September 12th is a Democratic primary for mayor, and you and the incumbent Tony Harper are on the ballot. Your name is also on the ballot on November 7th. You'll be an unaffiliated candidate. Did I get it right, the 7th? Yeah. No, unaffiliated candidate running for mayor against whoever wins the Democratic primary. So you'll either be running against Marcus Packer, the Democrat, or Tony Harper, the Democrat. And there are there's one other minor party candidate who's not looking to win, just trying to get 1% of the vote for the Working Families Party. So to get on the ballot, it wasn't a big deal getting on the general election ballot. You needed only 122 signatures of registered voters. But it was a real challenge. You had only 2 weeks because of these crazy rules we have. You had a total of 2 weeks in July and August to gather 1,872 signatures of New Haven Democratic voters on petitions, which really means you have to get 3,000, which you did, because often they get someone gives you wrong information or they don't like your handwriting or something. They disqualify some of them. You did all that in 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and you got on the ballot.
Absolutely.
What was that experience like?
It was a fantastic experience, Paul. It gave me an opportunity to go out there and engage voters and to let them know that from my perspective and from the perspective of a lot of New Haveners, they deserve an option in this year's election. We live in a democracy. We live in a place where dissent and debate is commonplace. And I think it does the residents of the city of New Haven good to have competitive elections. And just to be clear, to clarify, it wasn't just the state rules that said that I had 2 weeks to get those 1,900 signatures. The Democratic committee in New Haven could have had their convention a little bit earlier, so we could have.
So the rule is, it has to be, because I wasn't familiar with this. Rule is, once the party has a convention, then other people have until this deadline of the first week of August. Is it?
That is correct.
Second week of August?
Well, it's like, I think it was the 9th.
Okay, yeah. August 9th. So August 9th is what the state sets, but the city could decide when to have its convention. Are there any parameters within which, because they've had it in June?
Well, I've heard that they've had it earlier in the past.
I mean, they're allowed to. So why do you think, I guess it's an obvious question, they don't want to give you a lot of time because they want to have their candidate get in the ballot, right?
That is correct. But what the residents of the city of New Haven stated very loudly and very clearly is that they want to have a competitive election. And to me, that is the foundation of our democracy. Our elections should not be coronations. They should be about the issues that are affecting the residents in a real way. And they should be always about the needs and wants of our citizens.
So having to collect all the signatures, and you personally got close to 1,000, right? You collected yourself about 1,000.
Absolutely.
1980, back 8 million years ago, I actually collected petitions for a presidential candidate named Barry Commoner. We got like 30,000 statewide with the Green Party. I remember what a hard process that was. You got to work for everyone.
Sure.
You got to convince people. Sometimes I want to ask you what you believe about the issues. Other time, you just want to convince them, whether you agree with me or not, you got to believe in democracy. We'd like to just get on a ballot. And that's hard work, one by one. So you grounded it out with almost 1,000 people to sign to position yourself.
Absolutely.
So what were those conversations like? What were they asking you about before they signed? What did you have to tell them to convince them to sign on that line?
Right. Well, the conversations were very diverse. Some of them ranged from folks being okay with the current state of our city to those who were totally despondent and apathetic towards the political process. But what I told them was that it's important that we set a good example, especially for younger generations, that we are a nation of laws, that we are a nation of people that value competitive elections, and that we value debate. We don't want to stifle that in any way whatsoever. And that by them signing my petition, they were not necessarily voting for a PAC administration, but voting for democracy. And I think that message resonated very well with a lot of people. And obviously, I made the
including ballot. HARP voters.
Absolutely. I had a lot of HARP supporters sign the ballot. And unfortunately, they caught a lot of flack for that. But to my earlier point, the petition process was about engaging voters. It was about letting them know that they had a choice in this year's election, and that we should have a substantive debate about the issues affecting most New Haveners, like senior services, like youth services, like affordable housing, like economic development and workforce development. These are the issues that are affecting New Haveners every day, and those were the issues that I was speaking about to them, and how I plan on making New Haven a better place to live, work, learn, and play.
And one fun part I remember from petitioning, even though it's not very efficient when you're trying to rack up the numbers, is that people love to tell you what they think needs to be done. What do people tell you they think needs to be done in New Haven?
Well, it's real funny, Paul. A lot of people talk about youth services. They say, well, the kids don't have the types of programs that I had when I was young. Having grown up in New Haven myself, I think I bring a unique perspective to that, because I remember a lot of youth programming. And
what do you remember doing?
Well, I remember going to the Q House, taking piano lessons.
Oh, you play piano?
Yeah.
Still?
A little bit, not a lot.
What kind of stuff you like to play?
Well, just regular show tunes.
You like show tunes?
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you who else liked to play show music on piano.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, this is a zinger.
Really?
Tony Harp's late husband.
Well.
And he liked to play cool jazz on the piano. He was a pianist. Well, played with Donny Hathaway.
Really? I never had a chance to talk to him about that, but that's very interesting. I remember, you know, my Youth at Work program, a summer job at Hill House, working with the late, great Ben Hunter.
He was the guy who did all the basketball leagues, youth sports.
Absolutely. My first job was working for him for $5.25 an hour in the summer of 1990. So these programs are the types of things that folks spoke to me while I was out getting my signatures. And what I tell them is that we have to be better stewards of the taxpayer dollars. We have to start prioritizing a little bit more effectively what the needs of our communities are and how we're going to address those needs in real time. And that's why I want to make sure that I'm the type of mayor that is hands-on. I'm going to be the type of mayor that is going to be willing to roll up his sleeves, make the tough decisions, not give folks a lot of political platitudes just for catering purposes, but actually have substantive, honest conversations about the state of our city. So when I read articles, especially on your publication, about, you know, them unveiling the new Q House in November, to me, it seems very political, because we have over $1 billion worth of brand new schools that we can be better utilizing for the needs of our children. And that's why I plan on utilizing our assets a lot more effectively than this current administration, and hopefully save the taxpayers a lot of money.
In the comments threads to the Independent, that comes up a lot, the point you just make, about how we spent actually $1.6 billion at last count, or $1.7, fixing up or rebuilding from scratch all of our city schools. When we did it, we talked about returning to the community schools concept of the 1960s, where you have a nice school, not just to have it to be, in the, most importantly, a good place to learn during the school day, but to be open to the community later every day, whether it's services for out in West Rock originally, for families getting health care and job training, or just places for kids to do stuff. The community schools, we had that. It seemed to wither somewhat in recent years. We had the basketball leagues after school. Are you suggesting the way that some people have, Marcus, that we didn't need to build a new Q House? We had to use all these brand new schools that are underutilized after 3 o'clock every day and put the programs in there?
Well, what I'm saying is that there's more than one way to accomplish things. And what we have to do, especially in light of the state deficit, which is in the billions of dollars, we're living in a city that is looking and laying off folks in our educational system and our health department and things like that. We have to be more cognizant of how we spend our dollars. And I'm not saying we don't need a new Q House, but what I'm saying is that we're not utilizing the assets that we have now to its full effectiveness. So what I would do as mayor is I would look a little bit more diligently at how to better utilize our current assets so that we can take care of the needs of our residents in a more cost effective way. And that doesn't mean that you don't bond or, you know, things like that. But what it means is that if you're going to have an honest conversation about with taxpayers about where their money's going and is it being spent wisely, I think a lot of folks would say that it's not. Whether you're looking at a $5 million deficit at the police department less than 2 months into the fiscal year, whether or not you're looking at Husky workers being laid off at the health department and Board of Ed folks that deal directly with our children, we have to ask ourselves these tough questions. And this is an area that I feel very, very passionately about because I know for a fact that people are being priced out of our city. There's a lot of
folks. I definitely want to get to that housing issue. I want to keep going with this issue if we can. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking this morning, I tried it before you came out. I tried to put myself in the position of the politicians I interview. What if I were in their spot? And I think about that issue you're talking about where you have these buildings that got paid with bonding money. Mm-hmm. How do you keep the programs going there year after year when there's not a lot of money? This is not an original idea. I wonder whether with just a little money, we could partner with more community groups to run those after-school programs.
You're absolutely right. And I see
I don't know.
No, those are happening. Those types of programs are happening. I mean, when I was out.
Like Solar Youth. Can we get them into a school? Or well, maybe we don't need to. I don't know.
I saw specific programs at the Columbus School where they have after school programming almost on a regular basis where they bring in.
And Lincoln Bassett brings in Concat. Yeah.
Yeah. They bring in social service agencies. They bring in mentors. They bring in tutors primarily Hispanic speaking neighborhoods. And they help these folks after school. And I'm saying, why can't those types of programs be replicated all across the city? We have 52 schools for about 20,000 students. So we have the space. We have the asset. But what we're not doing is we haven't found the courage to go ahead and implement those things and make it a priority. And that's the difference between me and what this administration is doing. I have the courage to make these tough decisions, to prioritize the needs of our children and others. And
so what wouldn't get funded so we could fund? Oh, you and I talked about it's not just that simple question. That you can partner with other kinds of groups. You could find ways to just be creative in how you fund these places. But in terms of tough decisions and courage, whom would you say no to so that there'd be money for more youth programs?
Well, what I would say no to is, number one, you know, patronage jobs. What I would say no to is duplicative city services. What I would say no to is excessive police and fire overtime. What I would say no to is litigation that should not be put on the backs of the taxpayers. And these are just a couple of things that are widely rampant right now in the city of New Haven.
So there are examples of patronage jobs that shouldn't be filled, except from the question of patronage, is whether the right person gets put in the job. Are there positions that are there only for patronage that, like, do we, what would be an example?
Well, I mean, look at City Hall right now. Right now, we do not have a legislative liaison to the state. We have no one up there fighting on behalf of New Haven up at the state capitol right now.
So would you eliminate to save the money?
Well, what I'm saying is that I would.
I see your point. They put somebody into work on the campaign instead. So what is the answer? Is that money we shouldn't be spending, or is that just a bad use of money we need to spend?
It's a bad use. It's both. It's both.
It can't be both. Either you're going to fill the position or you don't need to fill the position.
No. What I'm saying is that if there is a position and it's not going to be utilized for what it was brought into existence for, then it shouldn't be there. And to me, if a person or a leader feels that position shouldn't be there, then you have to ask yourself, why was it there in the first mm-hmm. place? So we have some serious things that we need to speak about. What I want to do is I want to be open and communicative and honest with the taxpayers. I want them to know that their leader is not going to spend their money all willy-nilly.
Or duplicative services. What would be an example of that?
Well, duplicative service would be something like, in my opinion, the food policy director's position. Where we have,
I think that was grant funded though, right? So that didn't come from taxpayers.
Well, it doesn't matter. That grant money could have been used somewhere else. We could have put our resources toward getting a different
maybe
type
a food
of grant.
Program after school in this. Maybe there's even grant money for some kind of food policy in the schools.
My point is, Paul, is that there's five or six, you know, food policy organizations, nonprofits in New Haven that deal with that issue already. So there was no reason for us to have to take it inside of City Hall, because after the grant runs out, what normally happens is that grant is put into the general fund budget as a permanent position. So we have to be cognizant of how we're spending taxpayer dollars and be better stewards of
the dollars. So slippery slope. Once you bring the grant, then the grant runs out and you end up funding the position.
That is correct.
How are we doing with prison reentry? That's a somewhat grant-funded position.
Well, you know, when I attend homeless meetings almost every Tuesday at the Trinity Church on the Green. A lot of those folks are fresh back from prison. And what the feedback I'm getting from them is that the city's resources as far as dealing with this very important issue is very limited. What we need to do, in my opinion, is focus on partnering up with larger programs, statewide programs, federal programs, to ensure that we're addressing the needs of our prison reentry population in a more effective way. What I want to see is that we're going to be providing them wraparound services. So not just jobs, but also housing, also mental.
Now we have a whole staff addiction. That's supposed to be doing that. Is it doing it?
You have to go out there and ask those people. I'm not hearing that it's being done enough, or folks aren't getting everything that they need from that program. I'm not saying that the folks working there aren't hard workers. I'm not saying that they don't know what they're doing. But what I'm saying is that from what I'm hearing on the ground, is that they're not receiving everything they need. So we need to look at how we're going to better serve that population.
And what you're hearing on the air is Marcus Packer, who's running for mayor in both September 12th primary and a November 7th general election in the city of New Haven. He's here on Dateline New Haven at WNHH, your home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at New Haven Independent. Alex Taubes, thank you for writing in on Facebook Live. Alex says he's having trouble with the audio over Facebook Live. Our station manager, Harry Jones, is working with that. Harry, does that look like it's all settled? Alex, why don't you write us back in and see if it's still working well on your program over there, and thank you for contributing. Marcus Packer, I interrupted you before. You were moving on to a second issue, which was I considered the most interesting part of your first debate against Tony Harp, which was a really lively debate at Varick Church two Sundays ago. And the one issue, and this is why we need elections so much in our city, why we need competitive elections, is that there are important issues that people care about that aren't always so easy to solve, and that intelligent, sincere people can have different opinions about, and that no one has found a magic bullet to solve. And one of those is affordable housing. Mm-hmm. You brought that up. And there are a lot of interesting aspects to that discussion. Like, you brought up the word gentrification, because we're going hog wild building market rate housing in New Haven. And to some people, like, just lots of new projects, was Novella, 360 State, two on the rolls, right in Worcester Square by Olive Street, 11.6 acres in the hill that lay fallow for decades. We're not even bribing people to do it anymore. The market's there for the, you know, up to $3,000, like in Winchester Avenue, $3,000 a month. Never thought it would happen. I'm not sure it's going to be happening in a year. But anyway, so that's happening. And there's a lot of debate about, and what else is happening, which it sounds to me like you're hearing a lot on the doors, and we hear a lot at the Independent, is that there's an affordable housing problem in New Haven. People are getting priced out of New Haven. They can't afford to live here. It seems like we're getting to be a city of either subsidized very poor people or wealthy people can pay thousands of dollars a month for an apartment. The middle and the working workforce houses get squeezed out. So the question then becomes, what do you do about that? Mm-hmm. And what Tony Harp says is that this technical definition of gentrification is when there's a building that has working class people living in it, or poor, they get pushed out and the place gets renovated, or maybe not in New York, and then you just charge a lot more rent for richer people. In not a single case of market rate housing in New Haven has anything been torn down. They've built on vacant lots. So the argument there is that that helps everybody for two reasons. One is that it builds up the tax base, so we have more money for government. We have more people to go to stores. And that as people who might have been living in what used to be higher cost housing in New Haven move there, the old housing becomes affordable, as happened with condos that were overbuilt in the 80s. The counter argument is that some people believe that higher rents coming to town push all rents up. And this is an honest disagreement, whether this happens or not. Some people say it lowers other rents. Some people say it raises them. A counter argument is that gentrification has a broader meaning, which is that the cities and policy get geared to the wealthier people and it doesn't trickle down. A counter argument is that the discussion is not paying enough attention to people who might earn $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, have a kid and can't afford New Haven. And then the administration comes back and says there are less known publicized projects like Juan Salas Ramos project by Munson Street at the old Cardinals, that the insistence that when Chersey South get rebuilt and include 30% affordable housing to replace all the units, that the 11.6 acre project in the Hill includes a 30% affordable component. That's the backdrop. We know what the Harper administration says about this. What does Marcus Pacus say after listening to what people in New Haven say about affordable housing?
Well, Paul, I'm glad you know the Harper administration's policy towards this gentrification issue so well.
Well, I was at the debate. Yeah. That's what you said.
but one thing really stuck out about what you said, and that has to do with trickle-down economics, trickle-down politics. And if we go back to the 80s and we look at how Reagan used that to
and
justify
DeLito,
his used it to explain his economic development policy. As we know, it didn't end well for a lot of black and brown people. What I'm saying about gentrification is that our primary focus as a city just cannot be on market rate housing. We have to have low income housing. We need to have a focus on affordable housing. And the fact that the Church Street South project is geared or slated to get 30% low-income housing, is that correct? Low-income housing?
That's out of 1,000, so to replace every unit that's lost.
To replace every unit that's lost, I mean, like, those families are gone forever.
The argument was that they got vouchers, so they still had the affordable housing, and this would actually add to the amount of affordable housing in town. They still get to live other places with their voucher. They get first right of return, but then 300 new units is something legal aid fought very hard for.
Those folks lived in squalor. They lived with they lived in some of the worst conditions in our city for many, many years. And this administration turns around and works with the very developers that let this happen for a very, very long time. So excuse me if I don't feel like this is really a good situation for the people that were displaced. What I'm saying is that we have to be cognizant, especially as a leader, of all of our residents. And PACA is not against market rate housing. I am pro development. I'm pro economic, solid economic and community development. But I believe that we are going to be judged based upon how we treat the neediest in our communities. And right now, the neediest in our communities are telling me when I knock on their doors that they cannot afford the rents, that this so-called theory of trickle-down housing policies where, you know, people or rich people move in and the people taking their places are poor people and rents get lower, it just isn't happening on a scale that's going to be large enough to.
And then before I've gotten you into the fine points of policy, there's a broad point you're making, which is that New Haven is saying we can't afford the rent.
Well, that's the broad.
An important broad point.
It's huge.
You're saying this is something New Haven feels right now.
This is what New Haven feels, and what I know is that I have my finger on the pulse of our community because I'm out there every day earning votes. I'm out there talking to residents. I'm out there talking to mothers. I'm out there talking to business owners. And whether or not they're an elderly lady living on Orange Street who can't afford her taxes and because they're like $15,000 or $18,000 and she may have to move out of her home that she's been living in for 60 years, or it's a single mother in the Hill section that can't afford a $1,200 a month rent for a two-bedroom apartment, I think all of these issues are combined.
So right, and we can't lose fact of the big point like that when we get into the weeds. We do need to talk about just what people are feeling right now in New Haven.
Well, because for me, this is more than politics. For certain people, including my opponent, yeah, this is politics. I mean, you know, she's going to say certain things that are going to sound good to certain people to earn their support. But what I know is that politics aside, I care about people. And people are far more important to me than politics. So when I speak to these people, and I see the tears in their eyes because they can no longer afford to live in a city that they were born and raised in, where their families are. To me, something needs to be done. And if enough people feel that way, then I think it is the responsibility of the city government, of our local government, to address those needs more effectively than they have been.
Okay. So how do we do that?
Well, the way that we do it is we redefine our priorities. we start saying, hey, listen, we are going to promote all types of economic development, but we are not going to stifle market rate rents. We're not going to stifle affordable housing or low income housing at the expense of many residents in our city. We are going to be inclusive of all people. We are going to maintain the identities of our neighborhoods, because without people, you don't have any neighborhoods. And New Haven has so many diverse cultures and religions and backgrounds. And that's the reason why people come here, because they feel that. They feel that sense of neighbor community. And we want to continue that. So it is very, very important to me, and it will happen under a PAC administration, that we have programs like a New Haven Housing Trust Fund, which is going to be a collaborative.
Tell me about that.
It's going to be a collaborative of philanthropists, major donors, local businesses, and city officials to basically come together on a regular basis to talk about strategies on how we're going to level out our housing market. How are we going to provide the high rent places for folks that can afford them, because we love those folks too. We want those folks to feel safe. We want them to feel that our city's vibrant. We want to have all the amenities that they can afford, because they've probably earned it. But we also need to make sure that our low income and our affordable folks, the people of more meager means, also have opportunities to live in safety and peace and prosperity, just like everyone else. So this collaborative is going to come together on a quarterly basis to plot out those strategies. They're going to focus on grants. They're going to focus on bringing in fresh new developers who focus on these types of housing. And we're going to actually put a strategy around how we're going to level the playing field.
You brought another specific up before, which is that you felt, it sounds like, tell me if I'm wrong, that while you don't disagree with making Chersey South 30% affordable housing out of 1,000 necessarily, sounds like, you do disagree about working with Northland Development as the developer to do that.
If you were living, and you and your children were living in moldy conditions with appliances that didn't work, and lead paint all
asthma.
Over the place, asthma and lead paint all over the place, I think you'd feel a certain type of way too. Mm-hmm. I don't blame any of those people for taking those vouchers and getting as far away from that place as possible. What I don't agree with is that we allow those very developers who have left so many of our residents living in those types of conditions for so long to actually come back and partner with the city for the next phase of development in that area. So I do have an issue with that.
We were all shocked when that happened, and we asked why that was happening. Here's the reason we got. Was that Northland was told at first they had to clean up the place, and they'd had no promises of redeveloping it. They own the property. So, and they came here originally under John DeStefano with the promise to tear it down and have no affordable housing, or maybe 10%. And then that changed. Legal Aid sued them over conditions. They had to tear the place down. And that... The Hart administration says they proved in how they've worked with the relocation.
They what?
They claim that they weren't making any promises to them, but now in this process of relocating people, they claim they prove they can work with the city, and that you're avoiding, you talked about costly lawsuits before,
yeah.
That if you feel they can do it, if you don't go with them, it's going to be another 10 years before you can ever build there because it's their property.
That's one perspective. The other perspective is that the city should have dealt with these slumlords years ago, and it shouldn't have gotten to a point where something comes to a head and became a major emergency before action had been taken.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have been that students get asthma and other health issues before something happens. It shouldn't be before legal aid has to get involved in the great work that they've done to help these residents before something happened. And this is another stark difference. I want to be the proactive mayor. I want to be the type of mayor that sees a problem coming a mile away and takes care of it before it becomes a major issue, before it affects our citizens, our children, or our seniors in a negative way. And I think that's a problem with city government. It's become too reactive. Only when someone is ready to sue, only when things hit the paper, does anyone act. And to me, that's a problem.
So your point's well taken, that the real way you solve this problem is deal with it on the front end. Your point's well taken that people look at this and say, how in the world are you going to deal with Northland again? If you become mayor, you're going to be faced with a narrower decision when that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to decide what's the best thing to do.
Right.
Are they right that it makes more sense to work with someone if they prove more recently they can work with you and they own the property and that otherwise the thing won't get built and nobody will have housing for 10 years because they own the property? Or are they wrong about that? Are you going to do something different on this specific case?
On this specific case, I would have to get more details on the ground. But what I will tell you is that I would keep Northland on a very, very short leash. And I say that because they've proven themselves to not be responsive to the needs of our residents. And when they're not responsive to the needs of our residents, then it's the incumbent upon the city government to take action.
Marcus, other people would agree with what you said earlier, is that you shouldn't deal with them at all.
Well, yeah. But in light of the decision that's already been made, I'm going to have to take on a lot of the weight that has already happened under this administration.
Well, remember, they took on the weight, too, for Church Street South. That was 15 years. I mean, just this has been a long-range problem not being dealt with. But earlier you did say that I think a lot of people would agree with you that they still want to deal with Northland.
First of all, I'm not backing up on that position. What I'm saying is that if there's some type of legal contract that I don't know of that...
They own the property. It's not a legal contract. They own the property. Okay. So you can't just force them to sell the property. You can get all into their business, right, and make it hard for them and make it so... I mean, there are a lot of arguments about this. Some people would say if you have good enough lawyers and you mind your P's and Q's and you're smart about it, or you can sit down with them, you can get them to leave. But they're business people. They're not going to walk away until they make some money. They're going to say, we lost millions of dollars. We never got to build the project we were originally hoping to when Mayor DeStefano drove us around and then, in their opinion, caved to political pressure to have more affordable housing. Other people would say it should have been a lot of affordable housing to begin with. That's one of those kind of tough decisions that aren't good guys or bad guy decisions. You got to figure out what's smartest.
No, absolutely.
And a lot of people feel very strongly on both sides. There are people who say what you said earlier, that they can't imagine they would ever trust the people who allowed it to get to that stage to own that building again.
The only people I want to be responsible to is the taxpayers and the residents of New Haven. So if it's not in their best interest, I'm not going to do it. The way I feel about Northland is very, very clear. I don't think they should have gotten this far. But if they are involved and they do own the land, then what we're going to have to do is get creative. Like I said, I'm going to keep them on a short leash, number one. But number two, I'm also going to do everything I can in my power to ensure that whatever is the next development on that site is going to be something that's going to be beneficial to the taxpayers and residents of our city.
All right. And those residents and taxpayers are listening to Mayor Monday. Oh, excuse me. That was Mayor Marcus Monday.
Now, that was called fortuitous.
Okay. Well, if you get in, we got to do Mayor Marcus Monday. This is Mayor Candidate Tuesday. This is Marcus Paca on Dateline New Haven. WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Robert Gibson writes in, yesterday the mayor was asked about the homeless on the green and the resultant deterioration from homeless encampments there. I don't know if they're encampments, but the homeless people hanging out there causing a lot of problems. Trash, urine, mentally ill, and drug addicted. What would you do to keep the green safe and clean for everyone? And thank you for that question, Robert Gibson, and thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Gibson. The homeless issue in New Haven is extremely concerning to me right now. Just last night, I took my my wife out to dinner and downtown. And
where'd you go?
We went to, what's that place?
Where do they serve? What kind of food?
Heirloom.
Well, I haven't been there. Heirloom?
Heirloom, right on Chapel Street.
Oh, that's the one that used to be at the corner of York.
Yeah.
You go down the steps?
Yeah.
And they farm to table?
Go up the steps.
Oh, up the steps.
Up the stairs. I believe it's called Heirloom.
But, like farm to table. Like natural ingredients grown around here.
Absolutely. And
was it good?
It was delicious. and there was homeless people all up and down the street. And when I talked to these folks and I asked them, what's their story, a lot of them say, number one, that they've either just gotten out of prison or they fell upon hard times or they're battling mental or substance abuse. And I've made it a priority of mine to tackle this issue in a very meaningful way. So my direct answer to Mr. Gibson about how we're going to tackle the homelessness issue is to create a homeless consortium. And kind of like the business consortium, it will comprise come directly from the mayor's office and comprise of local philanthropic institutions. It will comprise of the hopefully the Chamber of Commerce, Yale, and some of our more robust nonprofits like the Columbus House and others who deal in housing and addiction issues to come together and talk about ways that we can strategize on how we're going to get a hold of this situation. Now, what I specifically propose is that we utilize some type of micro housing. that we create some kind of transitional housing opportunities for the homeless so we can have them in a place where they can get those types of services, so they can receive training, workforce development training, so they can receive their mental services, they can receive addiction services, and actually use that as a transition into or back into the regular job force or housing market. And to me, this only speaks to the best values of New Haven. Not only do residents in New Haven want to see this issue addressed, Yale wants to see this addressed. Businesses downtown want to see this addressed, because what's happening is that a lot of homeless folks, from what I hear from business owners downtown, are harassing or not harassing.
So a lot of people come from methadone from as far east as Willimantic, sure, as far west as Waterbury. For whatever reason, I think you're allowed to get some an app. You might be able to get new supplies with dirty urine and things like right. that. Looser rules. How do we deal with that? The cops have a tough job there in that first district.
Yeah, they have a tremendous job, and I commend them for the work that they're doing. What we need to do is talk to Yale about what types of methadone services are being offered in our city, because what I'm hearing is that a lot of these folks are now getting hooked on methadone. So they're coming here. They were hooked on heroin. Now they're coming to New Haven, and they're having issues with methadone.
And they're like zombies site. On the street.
They're zombies
and
on the
there's
street.
An opposite debate happening in the prisons, where New Haven has a program, unlike other prisons, where they let them drug addicts and methadone in prisons. And some experts say, and this is separate from the issue you're talking about, how do you do policy in a city when people come to a clinic and hang out on the street, which is really what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. They say in prisons, methadone is what actually works and gets them off that's better than being on heroin.
I would like to see the research, because that's not what I'm seeing. I mean, people seem just as hooked on methadone as they were on heroin. So we have a lot of work to do, and that's why we need a strong community services administrator that's going to focus on working with our nonprofits. Working
and again,
with
when
Yale,
you talk about the consortium methadone. On this, yeah. Am I correct in hearing that you're saying we don't need to create a city position? The nonprofits are doing it, have city play a convener job.
Well, I believe, Paul, that it's the role of government to create an atmosphere of positivity and proper work. I don't think it's the role of government to just be creating jobs for the sake of creating jobs. And therefore, if the government is doing what it's supposed to do and it's creating an atmosphere of growth, an atmosphere of collaboration and communication, then we don't need to create larger government. What we can do is work more effectively with our partners. We can communicate more effectively with them. We can work with them to get more federal funding and grant source monies coming into our city for these initiatives. And then we put the product directly out to the people. So the way I see city government is far more
And then you brought up micro housing, which is one of those issues, again, where people with good intentions on both sides have different opinions. Some people have floated micro housing. When you're talking about much smaller living spaces, they cost less to build, cost less to rent or own. In New Hallville and vacant lots that aren't community gardens, Eric Johnson, the former LCI director, suggested building micro houses, maybe 700 square feet. People can afford it and they have some land. Other people, for the wealthy market rate, are building these micro housing or planning to, whether it's a strong school or on Dwight Street near downtown, where they say they can cram more Yale students in and get more money out of it. Other people say it's a good strategy to make housing affordable. Then some people say that it's a bad strategy because it's too little space to live in and we're not that dense or don't need to be as dense as a bigger city where we have people living in too small spaces. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's easy for someone to say when they can afford their rent or their mortgage.
Yeah.
For the folks that can't, I think this is a viable option. I've spoken to several community groups and homeless groups about it, and they thought it was a great idea. So once again, we have to listen to our residents. Experts are great. We get advice from them. We read the studies. We read the reports. But then it's up to the leader to actually make the decision. And what I want to do is I want to be a leader that has all of the information. I want to be a leader that just doesn't look at one or two options, but looks at 5 or 10 options so we can do what's best, what's in the best interest of our residents.
All right. Now, some residents is going to good schools. Yesterday, the school started for 23,000 public school students.
Sure.
New Year's there. You were out at school saying hello to them.
Absolutely.
Where'd you hit?
I went to Edgewood School on Edgewood Avenue.
And you went to Edgewood School when you were a kid.
Absolutely. And I also went to Sheridan Middle School, which I also did attend as a young person.
And you went to both those yesterday?
Yes, I did.
So what was it like going back?
Oh, man, it was great. It was great. I mean, you know, a lot of the kids I had seen walking their communities, so a lot of them knew who I was already. A lot of them ran up to me and gave me hugs, and they had my wristband on and things like that. Several of them introduced me to their parents. On the campaign trail, Paul, two of the best things that I've been able to do so far is connect with our young people and connect with our seniors. And those are the two groups that I really want to put a positive focus around, because far too often when budgets get tight, those are the two groups whose funding gets cut the first. Gets cut first. So I want to be the type of mayor that prioritizes the people that need our help the most, that from a city government perspective. And when I was engaging those parents and those students at Edgewood and Sheridan yesterday morning, I got a lot of positive responses. People have my back. People understand that New Haven needs a fresh new vision. People understand and feel my passion for helping New Haven. And to me, it was a fantastic, fantastic experience.
What, can you give me one example of something you would do different with schools if you were the mayor?
Well, I would do about 10 or 12 things, and before I go into that, let me just say, folks, because a lot of your listeners and a lot of voters around New Haven, they catch sound bites of what their elected officials want to do in their city. But for those of you who want details, solid details on my plans and vision for New Haven, please go to MarcusPacker2017.com for more details, and there you will see specific plans on how I'm going to make New Haven a better place. But specifically, I think that we need to be focused on whole child development. We need to be making sure that our students graduate with the proper reading and writing skills so that they can succeed in any post-secondary opportunity, whether it be a trade school or a 2 or 4 year college or the workforce. To me, that's more important than graduation rates, seeing how many of our students actually complete their post-secondary opportunities.
So more important is post-secondary success rates.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now you've talked a lot about reading. I've heard a lot about that. I even know kids who did very well in school. They went to colleges at New Haven Public Schools, and they were told they can come only if they take remedial reading.
Well, that's a problem.
And writing.
That's a problem, especially when they have to take those types of remedial courses.
So how do we shift gears on that? Yeah, you're right, even for Gateway,
Gateway, and it disenfranchises
basic
students.
Reading and writing is basically a loss at the moment. What do you do to change that? How do you change that?
Well, how do you change it? You change it by focusing on the basics. You have to make sure that social promotion, just for the sake of social promotion, just for the sake of stats, just for the sake of politics, is nowhere near our kids. We have to make sure that we're actually teaching our kids what they need to learn to succeed in life. So whether or not it's reading or writing or it's financial literacy, which I propose, we have to be more diligent and be more courageous.
And how do we teach that better?
Well, I'm not saying teach it better. What I'm saying, teach it
first.
Well,
I think we all think we need to teach it better.
Well, what happens is that
reading and writing does get taught, and it's not being taught. Obviously, you're not getting the results.
Well, no, what's happening is through social promotion, kids aren't learning at the proper rate or in the proper grade certain things, and then they're just moved on to the next grade, so they have
right.
deficiencies.
No, I know that,
there.
Yeah.
So what I'm proposing is that we stop doing that. What I propose is that we start having honest conversations about where their kids are in the school system and what their learning capabilities are and potentially hold some kids back if that's necessary. So that they can learn and they won't feel relegated to a second-class education once they move on and are with kids who have a higher level of understanding than they do. And again, that just goes back to us being honest with ourselves. That just goes back with us being honest with our residents, honest with our parents about the state of our children.
All right. And you're hearing that on WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. That's the program today. Well, 103.5 FM, Washington, the newhavenindependent.org. We're here with Marcus Packer. Running for mayor.
And Paul, I also wanted to talk a little bit about sanctuary cities.
You got it.
Okay, because
it's yours.
Yeah, that came up at the Varick debate, and some things were taken out of context that I wanted to address. And I wanted to address it because I wanted to be very, very clear about my stance, because it was definitely taken out of context, and including in your article, in all honesty, I think that that tweet that you have posted was not representative of what I actually stand for. Number one, the question that was posed about sanctuary cities at Varick was about potential funding that could be lost if the Trump administration goes through with withholding federal funds as they promised to sanctuary cities. Now, I made it very, very clear, and I'm going to make it very, very clear again to you and your viewership and your readership that I support sanctuary cities. I do not believe that any family should be torn apart because of their status. I don't think that federal agents or city agents should be coming into schools or hospitals and ripping families apart. I don't believe that any New Haven family should be living in anxiety or fear. But to that point, should hypothetically a scenario come where we are going to lose funds, I strongly believe that it is incumbent on a leader, especially a leader in New Haven, to have a contingency plan, to have some type of understanding of what's going to be at loss, because what's going to wind up happening is that those funds are going to have to be made up somehow. And if we have to take those funds from somewhere else to make up for potential funds that are being lost from a federal level, then we need a plan. And that's the type of person I am. That's the type of leader I am. I want to be diligent in all aspects of city government. And I think it's dishonest at worst and irresponsible at best for a mayor to suggest that such a scenario wouldn't require a contingency plan or a real-time response. So the Progress with PACA campaign is not going to move away from difficult conversations for the sake of political purposes. We are going to have those tough conversations. We are going to be diligent in our research, and we are going to make sure that New Haven has a strategic plan to deal with any type of action coming down from the federal
government. And obviously that answer is not going to please the activists, because what they want to hear is an answer to the question of, will that plan include saying that we will forfeit the money because we're not going to change our policy?
I'm not saying it won't. What I'm saying is that I'm going to have a plan on where that money is going to come from just in case we lose it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, I'm not saying there's anything right or wrong. I'm just saying that the question that everyone needs to hear from the politician is, are you willing to forfeit the money to keep the policy in place? You're saying that if we forfeit the policy, you need a plan. Are you feeling that plan is not in place? That point is very well taken.
That is correct.
There's still the question of, what will you do? Will you say, Donald Trump, I'm not changing the policy, I have some other plan to get the money somewhere else?
I have no plan on forfeiting the sanctuary city status. What I do have a plan on doing is making sure that is very, very clear to the taxpayers of New Haven what their tax dollars are going towards and how it's going to be used. I don't believe that New Haven can afford right now to lose any money, quite honestly. We're looking at a multi-million dollar deficit. The state is broke. We're laying off folks, and we need to make sure that we're taking care of all of New Haven.
So to the activists, that sounds like you're saying we can't afford to lose the money so that ultimately we won't. I know that's not what you're saying.
We're losing money right now from the state.
So what do we do if we can't afford to lose the money, and Donald Trump says you're going to lose the money, which, by the way, might not happen.
It might, exactly.
But if it happens, you're saying plan, point well taken. What is the plan? If he says you're going to lose the money if you keep the policy, and you're saying we can't afford to lose the money, is the plan that you will still say no to Trump and find the money elsewhere? Or is the plan that you would consider?
Well, Paul, do you know how much money it's going to be?
No, no one knows.
Okay. So since no one knows, then I can't answer that question. Okay. What I would say is that there's a difference between losing $100,000 and losing $10 million. Okay. And if as a leader, we don't have a plan on how we're going to make that up, then there's going to be an issue. What I want to let the taxpayers know, and what I want our sanctuary friends to know, is that I support sanctuary cities 100%. And I do not plan on kowtowing to the Trump administration. I don't think it speaks to the best values of who we are as citizens of New Haven and as Americans. So I am very, very clear on that. But what I am saying is that I will be the type of leader that plans a contingency around that to ensure that if we will lose funds, that we have a way to make it up so all New Haveners are safe. All New Haveners have opportunities to workforce development initiatives and economic development initiatives in our city, and that we are the best city that we can possibly be.
Man with a plan, Marcus Paca. His plan is to seek your vote.
Absolutely.
On September 12th in the Democratic primary for mayor, and on November 7th in the general election for mayor.
Well, hopefully not.
Well, you're still going to be running against the Working Families Party, pal.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And I look forward to that.
Okay. And then you still will get to hear Marcus Paca and Tony Harp, and watch him if you want, debate the issues in this mayoral race on Tuesday, September 5th. At 7 p.m. at Booker T. Washington Academy on State Street. And that's going to be live if you want to go there. It will also be broadcast on Citizens Television throughout the week before. So the discussion has just begun, and that's why we need competitive elections in New Haven. And that's why, Marcus Placa, I salute you for running for mayor of New Haven.
Thank you.
Throwing your all into it. Let the debate continue.
Let the debate continue.
Thanks for joining us today in Dateline New Haven, as it's named for the moment, on WNHH Radio. Thank you to our guest, Marcus Placa. We're going to take it out. And thanks for the questions and the comments in, including about our audio quality on Facebook Live. We need you guys out there to help us do the best we can. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here on WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.